Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome to a new episode of the Strong Source Podcast. And today we're here and super excited with this new guest, Chris Mahoney. Chris, where do I start introducing you? I mean, not just an amazing trader, maybe even a bit of entrepreneurial skill set in there, but also a medal winner at the Moscow Olympics in rowing. So I think, I know you're very sportive. So you know, when I speak to you, you're often somewhere maybe doing something more sportive than the actual trading still. But you've been head of Glencore for 18 years, Glencore Ag, from 2003 to 2019. You've touched upon sugar, coffee, all kinds of commodities. And now you're chairman of EDF Amman as non-executive director. You've been at Viterra. You also following, at least with the merger of Viterra and Bunge, as a possible non-executive director. Noting there that, of course, it's subject final shareholder approval and regulatory approval. But I think it shows already the long history you have in this fantastic industry that we're so happy to be in. So super exciting. I love sometimes speaking to you. I know you're already for quite some time. Super happy you're here and knowing a bit more and getting a bit more into your mind of this beautiful world of commodities.
Yeah, I'm also very excited that you're here, reading about your long history in the commodity trade. And what I also find interesting is that you have worked with some really big names in the industry. I read that you worked with Andy Hall.
Yeah, that's correct.
No, obviously.
Briefly, but 6 months.
No, obviously, we just talked about Huub Spierings, which is a legend within Cargill. Then even Glasenberg, the CEO of Glencore. I hope you have met Mark Rich. I don't know.
I haven't met. First of all, it's my pleasure to be here, yeah. Alex. Martijn, thanks for inviting me. No, I have never met Mark Rich.
Okay.
No. I introduced you already a bit more, but tell me, how did you end up in this beautiful world?
Well, by accident. I joined Cargill straight out of university. I was at Oxford in 1981. And at that time, I was rowing in the Oxford-Cambridge boat race, also in the Olympics the previous year. But I was so focused on the rowing that I could only choose companies that held their interview process after the boat race had finished. And Cargill was one of them. And I had the idea that I would go into something kind of like the financial or banking industry. And commodity trading seemed close enough, but it was primarily because they interviewed after April, when a lot of people interviewed in Jan-Feb, when I was more focused on rowing. So it was by chance, basically.
And you knew you wanted to in this industry because maybe you could have worked in an FMCG company or wherever, somewhere else, right? I mean, because we see that a lot of the people end up by coincidence in the world of commodities. It's not something you study for, especially in the past. Now you got some universities that do something, but it's still...
I did study geography, actually, at Oxford, although I mostly studied rowing. But and geography, of course, touched on commodity trading. And I think the sort of idea that I could travel and go to South America and the US and Australia, that had some appeal. But for me, it was, as I said, because they interviewed late in the year. There were other companies that also interviewed at that time, but they were food companies. I think Guinness Pete was one of them. And having to choose between Cargill and Guinness Pete was pretty easy, frankly.
It was an easy one. And if you look at your time when you started at the Cargill, I mean, how many years were you at Cargill before you went to...
I was at Cargill for 16 years, 81 to 97, and then, or 96. I worked for 1 year in the U.S., in Westport, Connecticut, with Andy Hall in FIBRA. And then I moved fortuitously in, I think, 1998 to Glencore, where I stayed until I retired executive-wise in 2019.
That's amazing. How was it the time at Glencore from the beginning?
Glencore was a fantastic company to work for. I mean, I think it could not have been better. It was the ag piece of Glencore was headquartered in Rotterdam, so it was somewhat separate from the rest of Glencore, which is headquartered in Zug. For most of the period there, I was fortunate enough to report to Ivan Glasenberg. There was no bureaucracy. The decision making was swift. The company was nimble. For such a large company, it was incredibly entrepreneurial. Ivan he put his faith, I think, in the people that he trusted, and then he gave you plenty of leeway, but you could always get in contact with him 24/7. No ceremony, just call him. He'd answer immediately. He'd answer at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And of course, the company had tremendous financial resources, which in the grain and oilseed industry was critical, because you could not convert a company from primarily a trading company to an ag handling and processing company without billions of dollars. And Glencore had that. So in terms of could you have landed in a better playing field? No way. It could not have been better.
If the game that you guys played in Glencore, could you explain a bit what you guys did there? What was so?
Yeah, I think all of the company did a similar sort of thing, or most of the company. In the late 1990s, it was becoming obvious that, and in fact, historically, it's turned out not to be quite this case if you look at the performance of companies in the last 3 years. But in the late 1990s, we thought that the trading business probably would become more difficult for obvious reasons. Better transparency, relationships were becoming possibly less important, yep. More liquidity, better access to information. And so we felt that the sort of pure old school trading would likely get more difficult. And the way to secure the business and expand the business was through the ownership of assets. And Ivan started buying coal mines initially in the late 90s, in the early 2000s. And Glencore had already set up the company Xstrata, which was its sort of public asset acquisition vehicle. And in ag, we started doing the same thing. We started buying country elevators in areas where the big players were not present. So in Russia, in the Ukraine, in Kazakhstan, we started with elevators and then port facilities and crushing plants. We tried to avoid particularly the US and to a lesser extent Brazil, where the big players were very active and the market was relatively mature. And we had the idea that if we could buy assets that were not only decent assets in the right locations of the right size, but also supported the trading business. That was very important early on, you know, because we didn't want to buy kind of a standalone asset that might have been a decent business, but was unrelated to the rest of the business. We wanted to buy stuff that would support and enhance the trading business and draw flows into the business. And we simply did that to greater and greater extent, culminating in a way with the acquisition of the Canadian public company Viterra in, I think, 2014. And while we were doing that in ag, Glencore, of course, was doing the same thing elsewhere. Coal, copper, nickel, zinc, etc.
Yeah. Chris, you describe it as if it's fairly easy, like buying futures on the screen, right? And I am very interested on how a process like that works. Because, look, if you're a trader on the desk, the structure of your day is doing your analysis, insight analysis, in-house analysis, and a lot of news or noise, if you will, you analyze that. Together with your team, you translate that into a risk-bearing financial exposure in the market, physical trade or futures. Now, but what you describe, you're a CEO of Glencore Agriculture, you were also sitting on that desk. Maybe you got reports in the morning about your financial exposures, but what you describe is more strategically driven, whereby you look at the market and the industry as a chessboard, and you make an analysis of what your competitors are doing, and you try to make an assessment of the direction of the industry. But then how did you, can you in a slightly more detailed way explain to the audience how that process works from having in your mind an analysis of the direction of the industry and how the business model of Glencore needed to evolve? You then say, well, okay, we need to buy these silos there and there. And then the value assessment. And then how do you approach that?
Yeah, it's a good question. Investment in assets and companies is not so different from trading itself. Of course, it's a longer term time horizon. And if you've made the wrong decision, it's difficult to get out. That's maybe the major difference. But what you sort of do is you start with a blank sheet and you think to yourself, in which countries is production and export going to grow? Where is there likely to be limited capacity? Where is capacity utilization going to be high? And you're looking probably, I would say, not 10 years forward, but 3 to 5 years forward. And you map out theoretically what types of countries might make decent investments from that perspective and from the point of view of drawing tons into the trading book. That's all very well, theoretically, but then you have to be able to actually action it, which means you have to be able to buy assets and businesses that are actually for sale, because you can't prize anything from anyone if they don't want to sell it, at least not at a reasonable price. So you have to be pragmatic as well. And that's basically what we did. We had a theoretical idea of what we wanted to do, which is not so different from trading ideas, arbitrage ideas. And then we just kept very much in touch with customers and suppliers and bankers and the markets in general to see what cropped up, to see if anything fitted. But occasionally we might go after something a bit more aggressively. By something I mean an asset or a company, but very often we were responding to what was available. And a big advantage we had was not only did we have the money and the support from Ivan and Barr, but we could act very quickly. We didn't spend our entire time doing that, of course, because we still had to run the company. We still had to put positions on and make money trading, especially in the early days. And of course, even when you own a whole slew of assets, and I think when I left Glencore Agriculture, which is now called Viterra, had something like 350 assets of different types, you still have to trade around them. Trading always remains a part of the business. You have to buy from the right place and move it to the right place and schedule everything and ensure that capacity utilization is as high as it can be. So it's just a big game of logic, but also pragmatism. Speed of action is critical.
But valuation of these assets,
yep.
Did you get experience along the way in that?
Yeah, I did. And I think a lot of the people who worked in Glencore, myself included, and particularly in Switzerland, and particularly Ivan himself, who comes from an accounting background, we were pretty good at that. I would say, compared to a couple of other companies I worked for, our financial acumen, we weren't all chartered accountants, but it was pretty strong. So we were basically looking at, I mean, it was simple. It was a cash flow analysis, the present value of the cash flows.
Yeah. So that is the model you use,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. We looked 25 years out, how much cash could be generated.
Now, there's also a topic that I always find interesting related to this. And it's what I've read often is that the assumed synergies of mergers or acquisitions is less than those who do it aspire. And especially in times when there is like an M&A fever or when there is money burning in the pockets.
Yeah.
Now, also, and I read something about that you said, and this was with regards to people, and that is related to it, where you say, well, it's better to build yourself or to hire yourself and then develop people yourself, then you have a bigger chance of having people with the right culture. Now, how do you look at the types of acquisitions of assets,
yeah,
which often include people when you buy a company? What is your experience with that? So both in terms of assets that you buy that have not maybe the same safety standards or technical standards,
yep,
or have not maintained in the same way. So buying assets that are not yours in combination with taking over people with maybe a different culture and a different, maybe a non-compliant culture, right? With Glencore or Cargill,
yep,
where you worked. How do you look at that?
It's a good question. I think when it comes to the trading business, you are better to rely on people from within the company who you know well, because it's only if you have worked with somebody for 3 or 4, 5 years through good times and importantly through bad that you really know them. And if you bring traders in from outside, they may have a good reputation, but you never really know. You can't be sure. You have to have worked with them. That's my experience. I also find, for example, that when you're interviewing people, it's very difficult to really figure out if they're going to be good traders or not. I wouldn't say that my interview techniques or success have been particularly stellar. But so with regard to traders and senior traders, it certainly was Glencore's style and Cargill as well to work with their own people and promote from inside. And I still believe that. Assets, of course, is different because you can build your own assets. Then you don't have issues of acquiring people and you don't have issues of the asset being the wrong size or in the wrong location, or maybe it's not compliant in terms of health and safety. But you don't really want to build assets if you don't have to, because if you're building assets, you're adding to the installed capacity. And that's not something you want to do. You want to buy existing assets, even if they may not be perfect. And if you want to buy a large set of existing assets in a country like Canada, for example, elevators, port facilities, crushing plants, all combined and connected, you have to buy a company. You've got no choice. Now, do people sometimes, when they acquire companies, fiddle around with some of the numbers to make it work? Maybe they do, but not within Cargill and not within Glencore, that's for sure. So in my experience, the synergy numbers and what we expected would happen did more or less happen. Did we make a couple of mistakes along the way? Yeah, of course. But I think the big calls, at least within Glencore Agriculture, turned out to be correct.
Does it take a long time to acquire these kind of assets? Is it you start looking at them and then before you, is it takes a year, 2 years? Is it fast? Is it months?
It depends. As I said earlier, first of all, the asset has to be for sale or the company has to be for sale.
Yeah.
If you're trying to pry something away from somebody who doesn't want to sell it, the value outcome is not going to be great in all likelihood. The combination of, maybe it didn't turn out in quite the way that we expected, but the combination of Glencore Agriculture, which became called Viterra, and Bungie was 15 years in the making. So yeah, it takes a long time sometimes. But when we acquired Viterra, for example, in 2014, we started looking at Viterra, which was then a Canadian public company, because the Canadian Wheat Board had just been dismantled. And the same with the Australian Wheat Board. And until those two boards were dismantled, neither Canada nor Australia were free markets. And both countries were big exporters of wheat and barley, which were both key trading commodities for Glencore at that time. So we started looking at Viterra, the Canadian public company, in response to that. And then things moved pretty quickly. I would say within 8 or 9 months, we had acquired Viterra. But if it's a single asset, a single crush plant, it can be pretty quick. It can be a matter of 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
In trading, you have some famous traders, big egos, some names, they're only known inside of a company.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was looking at your career, I also came across one name which I'm interested to hear from you, because nowadays the oil market is getting a lot of attention, crude oil.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, so who is the king of oil? The book, The King of Oil, is about Mark Rich.
Yeah.
But if you think about the last couple of years, who almost received that name? There was Pierre Onderant, seen as one of the most outspoken, known, successful oil traders. But I thought about Andy Hall. Maybe not everyone knows Andy Hall, but I always thought about, okay, Andy Hall is known as one of the most impressive crude oil traders.
Yep.
And then I read that you worked with him in Philip Brothers.
That's right.
Could you share with our audience what he's like and how it was?
I don't know Andy that well. I worked with Andy or for Andy for maybe 6 months. And I was on the ag side in Phibro, and he was, of course, on the oil side. He was also the CEO of Phibro. He happened to go to Oxford University as well, and he happened to be a rower as well. So that's...
It was a good match.
It was a good match, and that is one of the reasons that I applied to Phibro, because I thought our similar backgrounds would give me an intro, which it did. So I don't really know Andy personally. I did sit actually opposite him, as we're sitting now, for about 6 months. I think Andy was simply very focused, looked at the market in a very sort of simple, straightforward fashion, looked 2 or 3 years down the road, did extensive supply-demand analysis, often was a contrarian, probably looked at historical highs and lows, and had the guts and the patience, and I suppose the backing from Phibro and the companies that owned Phibro to sit with it for 2 or 3 years, tune out the noise, and simply stick with it. And very often that works, and it probably still works today. So that was my impression, but I didn't really know Andy personally.
Then some others that you know better, we often ask our guests, who do you aspire? And so if you are an impressive trader, businessman yourself. And then it's always interesting to hear, okay, who do you find inspiring? Yep. Now, and you, in the intro of the podcast, you said Ivan Glasenberg and you said Huub Spierings.
Yep.
Now, when I started in Cargill, so I started in 97, so just when you left.
Yep, that's right.
Now, I didn't know the company much, of course, but then after about 6 years, I moved to Geneva, the main trading hub. And there I saw some people who were well known in the company.
Yep.
And then I also hear the name regularly. And that was Huub Spierings. And there was a Dutch guy. I'm Dutch,
yep,
as well. Yeah.
Yep.
So I was quite intrigued because everyone, so the big shots, the hot shots in Geneva, they were all talking about Huub Spierings.
Yep.
And I said, well, okay, so what is it? And he said, well, Huub Spierings, who was already out of the business, every once in a while, he still comes to the floor and he knows the S&D better than you. So the idea that you sit there as a diehard trader on your desk and that you know everything and Huub passes by the desks and points at a certain element, which is wrong. I thought it was fantastic. And he had like some kind of a photographic memory, whatever. And everyone I spoke to was highly respectful and impressed by him.
What was his role when he was in Cargill?
He was president of Cargill International SA in the 80s and 90s. Yes, you're right. And you asked me before we met to name two people that most impressed me in the industry, and it would be Ivan Glasenberg and Huub Spierings. And I reported to Huub directly for 6 or 7 years, I think, in the early 90s. And Huub, I don't think he would know the S&D better than the traders. I certainly would hope not. He certainly didn't know the sugar S&D better than I do, that's for sure. But he was an incredibly logical, direct, unbureaucratic, and humorous character who would defend his people to the hilt, who would fend off the bureaucracy from Minneapolis, who was a pure trader through and through. And if you, in terms of a pure trader, and I can only talk about the people that I know, I think he was the best. And he was a great guy. And as I said, extremely humorous and made you feel comfortable. And he was...
What was his
there
edge?
Was no one better.
What was his edge and what made him so special, so talented?
Special in the commodity trading business is we're not working in the tech world where we need to be geniuses, thankfully. In fact, Ivan always used to say to me, you know, we're lucky we're not in Silicon Valley. We're just up against simple commodity traders. And I think that's true. So he was just direct and straightforward and extremely logical and could cut to the point quickly and humorous and make people feel at ease. Nothing more than that. There's nothing, you know, commodity trading is part the game of mathematics, of course. And I think unless you have a kind of logical mathematical mind, that there's a certain prerequisite for that. And Huub certainly had that. But beyond that, it's all human touches.
Yeah. And I think you touched base on something critical. Now, there is a mathematics part indeed. Fine. But a lot is psychology. And I think now I think about it, what I also asked about him is that he was able to run huge positions. And when they went against him, he was not deterred.
Yeah, could be. Yeah. I think that's probably right. And that's important. If you don't run big positions at the appropriate times, you can't make big money, of course. Having said that, I think a keen sense of fear is always a good thing.
Yeah.
You don't want to have too much bravado.
Yeah.
And I have always felt that if we've done thorough analysis and we think we've done the right thing, taken the right position, and if it goes against us, I don't like it, but I'm not going to lose too much sleep.
Yeah. Look, I think that's also a very critical thing. You mentioned fear, and the fear is just an indication that you remain always open-minded.
Yeah.
So fear is not something negative. It means it's a bit like a certain skepticism that you need to have as a trader. Yes, confidence is important and an ability to trust your judgment, but fear means that you're always open for elements that contradict your analysis and your position. And there's some things that you mentioned here I like to touch base on a bit more, because we talked before the podcast about the role of social media in terms of showing what trading, investing is, and in my mind, not giving the good example. So you said simplicity. We are not in Silicon Valley. That is correct. And sometimes an S&D may look simple, but the craft of making the S&D is not simple.
It's relatively simple compared to Silicon Valley. Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think my experience is the best things to focus on when you're trading, not the flat price, because trying to figure out the S&D that is going to influence the price of soybeans, that is complicated. There are so many things that impact it, from psychology to weather to endless things. But I think if you focus on certain arbitrages, for example, if you can buy wheat, you can't today, but if you can buy wheat in the interior of Russia and you know how much it's going to cost to transport it to the ports, you know the sea freight to Egypt, you bring it to a CIF-Egypt parity, you compare that to the price of wheat in other origins, and you know how much Russian wheat is going to be exported, you know when it's going to run out, you know when the parities have to converge. If you stick to those types of things, it's not complicated mathematics, and you have to be able to execute it, which means you need people in Russia, you need silos to carry it, you need port facilities or access to them. But if you stick to simple things like that, 90% of the time, you can't go wrong. Where people go wrong is when they get dragged into trading the flat price, because in a way it's simpler and therefore more appealing. And then there are a myriad of items that they can't quantify. Another mistake people make, in my experience, is they think they have to have a position every day of the year, which is nonsense. How can that possibly be the case? You can easily make money, and in fact, I think it's the way to do it, if you only carry a position 10 days of the year or a month, because it's only every now and then that the parities get obviously knocked out of line. I have seen occasions when the parities have been ludicrously out of line. I can remember one occasion in the wheat market when Chicago, driven by speculators, I think it was above 20 cents a pound, soft wheat in the US, and it was trading at something like a $30 or $40 premium, or maybe even more, $60, $70 premium to EU wheat, FOB. And the parity was such that you could comfortably export EU wheat to the United States, which was itself a net wheat exporter. No, so that was clearly a parity that was going to collapse. And yet people were fearful of trading it. So I don't think the maths is that complicated. It's one thing to do the maths. It's another thing to be able to execute the trade. So, for example, investment banks could probably do the maths, but they don't have the facilities or the people to execute the trade. And at Glencore, when we were primarily traders in the early 2000s, we made most of our money with simple arbitrage trades, wheat, barley, soft seeds, simple calculations that, if you were patient, could barely go wrong.
Do you think that you had, because I think that a lot of our guests have seen that they said, well, the people in the teams that are doing execution of the trading is the key, one of the key elements, right? Who you have. Do you think that at that time in Glencore, you had something uniquely created with the people around you that you think like, yeah, you're nodding yes? So
I did think that, yeah. I mean, maybe I overestimate that, but I felt that in the early 2000s, certainly through to 2010, 2015, we had an excellent team in Rotterdam, 7-8 people, all with different skills. Some were very analytical traders. Some were very good relationship people. Everyone was willing to work hard. We worked very collaboratively because obviously 7-8 minds are better than one. We were tolerant of mistakes. We had great support from Switzerland. We worked very hard, and I'm quite sure it was an advantage. I'm very sure. I think we would not have been able to create the company we created in the space of essentially 12 or 15 years. Both in ag and Glencore as a whole, without that. I think the culture was extremely important.
Is that something you try to recreate in the companies that you're touching now?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I'm a non-executive, so it's a bit more difficult.
Yeah.
Companies are run by the executives, by the traders, by the executive managers, not by the board. But to the extent that I can contribute to that, then I would try to do that, yeah.
So there's a topic that I want to touch base on that is linked to some of the things we have already discussed. It's people, it's culture, it's about what do you do when a position goes wrong, what is the impact of having a team of traders that you haven't hired yourself or developed yourself. We also touched base on it with Jan Dieleman when he was here, and he faced something similar in the Cargill energy business, where later on there was an analysis made, which was sent through the company by Emery Koenig at the time, who was the head of the trading business in Geneva, where the cultural element was perceived as an important reason why a trade went wrong. Now, what I also thought, and maybe this is something that is the result of these type of events, when I worked in Geneva, so that was the early 2000s, there no one talked about the VAR or stress or drawdowns. It was simply wasn't there.
Yeah. For me, the learning was the best risk control mechanism is to know and trust the people. Better than the VAR, better than position limits. There's nothing better than that. If you know the character of the individual, if they have sufficient fear, if they know the market well enough themselves, that's your best line of defense.
I think what you said about the people, and I've said it also about compliance documents that are made by fancy compliance departments. You can have document, but at the end of the day, it's about what people do on the desk or when they are traveling and whether you can trust them. In the commodity business, you are challenged, not only in terms of risk-bearing positions, but also all kinds of opportunities within brackets, let me put it that way, to whereby some people may think, hey, this sounds a bit hanky-panky, but it's a great opportunity, and then you may end up on a sliding scale, right? And a VAR or a stress limit or a drawdown can provide maybe a false sense of security, because what people often underestimate is the ability to get out of a position in times of turbulence. And the liquidity, and one of the most striking quotes about liquidity is that when there's plenty of liquidity, it goes unnoticed. When there is no liquidity, it's the only thing you notice.
Yep.
So you need to have people on a trading desk who, well before they end up in a stress breach or a VAR, that they anticipate and say, well, okay, this is happening. Am I still able to do something about this position, whether to increase or decrease? Yep. But you need to have, now, and also what I often did, not when the shit really hit the fan, but when I started to feel like, something is happening and I'm not feeling that comfortable, I already started escalating to the higher echelons.
Yep.
The worst thing you want to have is people get surprised when you have no optionality anymore.
Yep.
So before you are in the corner, you start escalating, and then also tap into people who are not on the desk, who are not attached yet to a position, who can think straight.
Yep.
And then you sit with a couple of smart people and you say, okay, well, what will you do? And that you cannot manage with just these risk metrics. It's about a person who has the gut feel and experience who says, look, I need to escalate this before you end up in the ditch.
Yeah, I think that's right. You need all these tools, of course. You need the VAR and position limits and credit limits, and counterparty risk limits. That's a starting point, but clearly it hasn't worked for many companies, that alone. Look at the banks. But in the end, it's a matter of culture. You want to create a culture where people feel that it's their company, their money. You're all part of the same tribe. You don't have to be best friends, but you have to be willing to be honest and respect each other and not be fearful of raising problems. And it comes back to what we said earlier. And without that, all of these technical limits are not going to be sufficient, will never protect you.
Yeah. Hey, and even Glasenberg, could you tell us a bit more about him?
I hope he's not listening. Yeah.
I hope he's listening, actually.
Actually, I spoke to him yesterday because we still do a lot of cycling together. And he's...
Did he go to the Amstel Gold Race?
No, I went to the Amstel Gold Race. I raced in the Amstel Gold Race yesterday.
How are the legs feeling?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Now, Ivan is a very driven, very straightforward, also very humorous, highly competitive, and he would never expect anyone in Glencore to do anything that he wouldn't do himself. So, first into the office, last out, but remarkably straightforward and humble, just a very unique individual. I mean, obviously clever. And Glencore If you think about it, Glencore was a large trading company in the late 1990s, and now it's a mining company worth 70, 80 billion of the scale of BHP and Rio. And that was created out of thin air, essentially, in what should have been a competitive environment. And so all those big incumbent mining companies, they allowed us to grow from nothing. It's a tremendous wealth creation story outside of Silicon Valley, certainly in Europe. It may be one of the biggest ever. And Ivan, yeah, we had a group of 10 or 12 people, but Ivan directed it all.
What did you took from him, basically? You know, I mean, you already had so much experience. So were there any learnings or takes that you took from him?
Well, I could never work as hard as him, that's for sure. Not sure I'd want to either. No, again, just simple things. We had a group of very disparate and in some cases quite difficult individuals, all driven in their own way, and he managed to corral everyone and keep our noses pointed in the right direction and keep the company hungry and competitive and entrepreneurial, keep the bureaucracy at bay. I knew some of those things already, but I'd never seen it executed on such a scale.
In terms of something which I think is interesting for the youngest generations, work-life balance.
Yeah.
I read that Mark Rich, that he said to his wife, look, on a Saturday, I have 30 minutes for you. And on a Sunday, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
That is what I read. I don't know whether that is true.
I read the same thing. Yeah. Probably not true, but I read
it. Yeah. But now, then you just mentioned Ivan. And I read about you, and you can confirm whether that is true. You have a different approach. Your family is really very important. I think you said that you don't travel in the weekends. So what is your view about it?
Well, I had maybe a somewhat different approach. And I think Ivan, by the way, is not completely different to me. But I worked very hard in the week. I traveled probably 40, 50% of the time. But I really enjoyed it. I loved the work. I loved the people that I traveled with. And I loved the sort of intellectual challenge of it. I particularly loved going to South America and Russia and Australia. That's one of the nice things about the grain business. You can get out into the field and meet the farmers and meet silo owners. It's pretty real in that regard. It's not too esoteric. But at the same time, I tried not to travel at the weekends. I wanted to see my kids. I think I mostly saw them growing up. I wasn't prepared to sacrifice everything, and I don't think it was necessary. I think I said in another interview, there was one period where I did have to travel at the weekends. That was in the period running up to the acquisition of Viterra. But that was an exception. So that was my philosophy. The week is for Glencore, and the weekend is for my family and kids and wife. Yeah. And I pretty much stuck to that.
Yeah, I think that's a great balance.
I heard a lot about the book, The World for Sale.
I haven't read it.
No, I didn't want to read it because I thought, what can I learn from it, right? After having worked 25 years in Cargill. But I thought, you know what? I'm going to start reading it.
Yeah.
Also because I had a call with one of the authors.
With Javier.
Yeah,
I know Javier.
We were connected on LinkedIn and I was commenting to some of his articles on the cocoa market.
Yep.
Because he knows about cocoa.
Yeah, he knows the markets.
So I thought, okay, when I have an interview with him, I want to understand more about him and his book.
Yep.
And I myself also, I'm thinking for a long time already that I need to put some of my adventures on paper. So I thought, I'm going to ask him what it was like to write a book.
Yeah.
Now, so I started reading and I thought, okay, I know what it is like. What he writes is from interviews, but he has never worked for such a long time in Cargill. You have, and you have worked in Glencore for a long time. So what I thought when reading the first part of the book is like, they're talking about us as some kind of mysterious...
Yeah. Well, you have to sell a book, don't you?
Yeah, no, true. And that is the issue that I thought along reading the book. They need to sell something. And that is also why a lot of the news that I read about commodity trading and the big trade houses is written with a certain angle to sell.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah. And I thought, but we're normal people, yeah?
I hope so,
And the company is normal. So. And the role that the company has is a vital role in... Yeah. Providing food to the table of millions or billions of people.
That's right.
And the thing about, if you look now, the current themes, like the energy transition, you talked about mining, Glencore Mining Company. who the hell is going to get all those metals that you need for? So I often think that people, they go to the supermarket, that they don't even think where it all comes from, where it's produced from. And the electric cars, right? Well, there's a huge amount of metals in those batteries. Where do you think it comes from?
Far more than gasoline cars.
And energy. Energy is everything. It's not only the gasoline, but it's also your clothes.
Yeah.
Everything is energy. Yeah. So I thought what I find strange is that the way that it is written about commodity trading companies is not like, well, that's fantastic what they all do. They use a huge amount of capital. They take a huge amount of risk in very complex, unstable environments. And let's be happy with what they do.
Yeah, I agree. I think commodity trading gets a bad rap. I think particularly agricultural commodity trading, we get accused of manipulating the markets and setting the prices and driving prices higher.
Yeah.
And that I've been accused of that myself. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is complete nonsense.
Yeah.
We are responsive to the markets and we're moving foodstuffs from areas of surplus to deficit. And we're doing it in the most efficient way we can. So if Egypt is short of wheat and there's a particular crisis there, we try to resolve that as quickly as we can, taking risk in a competitive environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And more than that, I think importantly, what people don't realize is that we are building facilities, port facilities, warehouses, crushing plants, without capital constantly, which are effectively addressing shortage. Because without these facilities, without the addition of capacity, you can't move the food stuff. But
it's the unknown, right? It's the unknown that accuses, right? I mean, it's, we don't know.
And
I don't understand.
The stories in the news about how much money is made.
Yeah.
But what do you think those factories, what they cost? You need to make money in order to invest.
Yeah, and think about the numbers in relation to, for example, Silicon Valley. Vittal made, what was it, $13 billion PBT.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Elon Musk is worth $200 billion as an individual. So I think we do get a bad rap. And I think maybe a part of that is historical, going back to the days of trading with Russia in the 70s and grain embargoes and things like that. But one of the prime roles, particularly in the ag space today, is to build capacity that is needed to shift foodstuffs around the world. And that, I don't think, can be a bad thing.
No.
And that is probably 75% of the business today.
And we briefly touched base on cocoa in the introduction. And that's also a nice example whereby you see that if you look at the last couple of months, you can easily look at the COT report and you see that the speculators have been liquidating their length.
Yep.
And yet you have reporters who say, well, it's the speculators.
Yeah, no, I think the problem, cocoa now is hedge lifting, of course. It's people lifting short hedges.
Of course.
Because cocoa's not being delivered.
It's all kinds of things it was.
So maybe we need some kind of PR agency to represent the industry.
That's us. That's us. No, but look, that's us and that is you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what we try to do with the podcast is to show people like you who have a long career at credible companies and that they can see, well, okay, this is him. This is a guy like us, like all the guests that we had, where we show, where we show what the business is all about and no one has anything to hide. In fact, we want to do the opposite, show what a great and fascinating industry it is and the type of people that you can work with. That makes the job so interesting.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we've achieved that.
Yeah. Of the people that we mentioned, those are the people that get you into the office and that you, I've always thought, that I can learn from those people that helps to develop you professionally and personally.
And remember that we are making investments, building facilities, buying companies in difficult countries, particularly in the mining industry, but also in ag. You know, we're operating in Argentina and Russia, maybe not today, but in the past, in the Ukraine, in Kazakhstan. So we're sort of treading where other people might fear to tread, but it's necessary.
We need the raw materials. And looking at the timeline as well of this podcast, we're almost coming to an end. But I still have a question for you because now you're a non-executive director of different massive trading companies, Men, Viterra. You were a trader. You missed the old days? Or is this
Not really anymore. I think when I first transitioned from trading to management, maybe I did. But as I explained earlier, management is only, particularly if you're heavily engaged in M&A and building things and analyzing the world and deciding where and how to do that, it's a form of trading anyway. So no, I don't miss the trading today. I'm glad I started as a trader. And I think because I spent 10 or 12 years as a pure trader,
yeah,
I think that that helped me. I would not have...
It helps you now with your current
role. Yeah, and I don't think I would have felt comfortable being a manager in a grain and oilseed business without having had that trading background.
Yeah. Do you see that as a management, you get different kind of questions that they will come to you for because you have that experience?
I think so. I hope so. I think traders sometimes, perhaps to too great an extent, like to think they're special. And oftentimes it's a case of better to be lucky than smart. So if you're operating in the right environment, like that of the last 2 or 3 years, maybe it's easier to think you're special. But if they're dealing with somebody who knows what they do, has the same background, has the same experiences, I guess that helps. Yeah. Certainly doesn't harm.
We should probably also touch base on your best trade because you bought Viterra for $6 billion.
Yeah.
And I read that it was sold at $17, $18 billion.
No. Viterra was not my best trade. Viterra was in combination with a lot of people, including Glencore in Switzerland. I think, yes, was probably the best trade. We bought Viterra for $6 billion, but I think what people forget is we sold almost 50% of Viterra just after we bought it. We broke the company up. We sold a few of the grain assets to Richardson. We sold the fertilizer distribution business. We sold the fertilizer production business. We sold the petroleum distribution business. We sold the malting business. So in the end, we paid, I think, something like $2.7, $2.8 billion for Viterra. Nowhere near what people think we paid. So consider that, and I won't go into the details, but look at basically the recent transaction with Bunge, which is part cash, mostly shares, but based on the current share price, plus the earnings in between, I think you'll see that that was a pretty decent transaction.
So on that positive note, and that impressive note, we should thank you for a fantastic podcast.
This is fantastic,
thank you,
Chris.
Very nice to be here.
Another level. And I know you had silver at the Olympics, but for me, this is gold. So thanks.
Well, they are reconsidering the medals at the Olympics, you know. In light of the doping.
Perhaps you then get...
You never know. It's expensive
now, so it's a bit thinner now, the medal.
Yeah, you get thinner, but at least you got the gold. So let us know when you get the gold. Many thanks, Chris. It was fantastic. It was lovely and great to hear these stories. Many questions still I would love to ask you, but for now, we keep it as it is.
Yeah, thanks. It was perfect. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.